Hello, I'm Paul Scott, and today I'm interviewing the CEO and the CFO of Proactis, ticker PHD. So we've got Rod Jones, CEO, and Tim Sykes, the CFO, on the line. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, quick disclaimers then. This audio cast is for information only. I'm not giving any sort of recommendation or financial advice. I'm not charging a fee, and I do hold shares personally in the company as a long-term investment. So the share price is currently £1.19, which values Proactis at £47 million. So would you like to give a brief overview of the group, gents?
Sure, Paul. Proactis is a long and well-established software author and vendor of procurement-related software and, more latterly, services. So we provide software and services into many, many verticals of markets through public sector and commercial sector to help customers provide and deliver better procurement and purchasing processes.
Okay, and I know as an investor, a couple of the features I particularly like about the company is that your revenue is mainly recurring revenue on a SaaS model, and you've also got an impressive client base, I think. So maybe you could expand on those points a little bit more.
That's right. Over the 10 to 15 years that Proactis has been in play, we've developed and built relationships with about 500 customers, or blue chip customers as we describe them, all of which have had a long-term experience with us and have been using the software for a good number of years now on this SaaS-based model. So we do, the software is very sticky in that sense, and customers enjoy a long relationship with it because it keeps delivering value for them as they run their businesses.
Okay. And the results, the last set of results were for year ending 31st of July. So good results, I thought. There was 69% total turnover growth, and adjusted EPS more than doubled to 6.1p. The PE ratio is currently about 20, so clearly the market's forecasting more growth. So let's talk about growth a bit then. You delivered 12% organic growth last year, and we've got a question from a reader, John, who asks, why are you comfortable with 12% organic growth? Why not invest more in sales and marketing to drive more rapid growth?
Yeah, our strategy is four-pronged on growth stories. So the first two prongs are related in that they are around selling new software into new names, and our historic track record has been 30 to 40 new names per year. Second element of that is to put in and to upsell afterwards, and we've been very successful in that. So we win routinely 30 to 40 new names per annum and deliver 60 to 80 cross-sells or upsells of software additionally into existing clients each year. Now, there is an opportunity, of course, as John's identified, where you could invest even more money into sales and into marketing costs on an annualized basis, and even into product to try to drive the number of new names even higher. But we feel that the level of investment that we spend per annum in that in those three areas is optimally delivering the return of those 30 to 40 new names, i.e. that if we were to double our spend on sales, marketing and product, we wouldn't double our rate of return in terms of new names and upsells per year. So we feel that's optimum for Proactis, and we do want to be a profitable company. And of course, further investment in those areas would lead to a loss-making company, even if that were to be just in the short term. So our strategy is to be profitable as well as growing, and we feel we've got the optimum mix in those two areas. And that's delivering us a very healthy 12 to 15% per annum on average over a course of any 2 or 3 year period.
I think the other element should also be considered is how many companies come to market in any given period. So is there a market space that's, if you like, buoyant enough to support another 3, 4, 5, 6 salesmen and the necessary marketing effort? And it all comes back down to, at the end of the day, it's risk You're going to have to upscale when it comes to delivering the projects and implementations. All of that stuff sort of takes us out of our comfort zone. As Tim said, 10 to 12% is a pretty good organic record. We're comfortable delivering our sort of 40 new projects each year.
So we think that that gives us the best balanced view on profit and growth from the core businesses or from the organic side of the business. But we supplement that then with M&A activity, and that's been prevalent for us in the last 2 years. And then the year to July was the first full year that all three of our acquisitions had been inside the group, and that enabled us to deliver this overarching 69% growth, which was, you know, fantastic. And M&A is also of some risk, but also certain in another way. So you're buying turnover. We're buying companies that have long-term revenue and contracted revenue as well. So that's a crucial part of the attractiveness of any acquired company is their revenue mix as well, and that's got to be similar to our own. So high degrees of contracted or recurring income, delivering that security in the income statement that we think shareholders want. So that's our third leg of growth. And then our fourth leg of growth, just referring back even earlier, Paul, is to supplement that with this new thing that we are, this new opportunity that we have in accessing a new customer group through our software, which is the suppliers of our present customers. But perhaps we'll talk about that later.
Yes. Let's just finish off on acquisitions then, because we had a couple more reader questions about acquisitions. One reader just asked straightforward, how's the acquisition pipeline looking at the moment?
Really buoyant. We are busy in terms of our evaluations of opportunities, both short-term and longer-term. So we feel that there is a genuine opportunity here to consolidate a fragmented UK market, certainly. We've had success also with our first acquisition in the States, so we'd expect to continue to look in that geography. European markets are probably less suited to us, although Scandinavia is the sort of closest to us in terms of culture and how we might operate. So those would be our geographies for consolidation. There are very rare instances, you might say, where software companies get over and above, you know, 5 million and certainly 10 million before they get, inverted commas, swallowed up by something larger. We're sort of about 20 million as a software group now, tech group, and feeling sort of fairly vulnerable. So we're looking to bolster up and get to scale, and we see that scale as sort of at least 50 million of revenues over time. So we've got a very aggressive growth plan to try to get to that kind of scale over the next 3 to 5 years.
Okay. I mean, the obvious follow-up on that is to say that groups that grow aggressively by acquisition, usually things go quite well for a year or two and then the wheels come off. So, I mean, how are you tackling those sorts of risks?
Yeah, absolutely. We're aware of that. And as I described it earlier, you know, an M&A strategy is and can be perceived as risky. And in fact, we always describe our position so far. We've been doing M&A. I think our first acquisition was in February 2014, so just coming up 2 years. And we always describe our activity as we haven't cocked it up yet. We're sort of fairly pragmatic and practical folks up here. And so we're constantly working to make sure that the teams that we acquire continue to be motivated and get the right attention to try to deliver the results that we bought those companies for. And of course, you can buy a company for many, many different reasons and do different things with it, whether it be to you know, transition their customers to our own product over time, or to buy a piece of technology to harness and add to our own offering. So there's been a number of different reasons why we've acquired the companies that we have done, and we say that touch wood, and so far, and a lot of hard effort, we haven't cocked it up yet on those three that we've acquired. So we'll continue to look, and we're very cautious, and we don't buy everything, of course. So there are a number of companies that we haven't acquired, which we could have, just because the fit wasn't right for one reason or another.
Mm. And what sort of reasons do the vendors have for wanting to sell the companies to you?
Can be many. I mean, and different depending on each individual case. So, as an example, on our first acquisition, it was the last investment of an institutional investment fund, and they needed a private equity fund, and they needed to clear out that final investment to close down their fund. And so, in terms of getting a decent price as well, actually. And then from another angle, similar story, but it was a go-forward product. It wasn't the final investment, but they, as an investor, had had that investment for 5 or 10 years, and the rate of growth that it was achieving wasn't going to increase its value very much over time. And we acquired it because it was very well consumed within what we already do and could do something at the cost base. So it meant a different thing to us. And it had a fantastic level of recurring fixed contracted income. So that was a different reason for acquiring that business. And then the third one was precisely because of the capability that they had for where we were headed with our supplier networking capability requirements, for where we want to go over the next 3 to 5 years. And we needed a certain and specific piece of technology and capability. And we acquired a great commercial guy with that company too. So. Many different reasons for acquiring it, and many different reasons for shareholders selling.
There is a common factor across most of them. It's the type and nature of the customer. The customer tends to stay with us a long time, have a long-term relationship with us. They're not chopping and changing. So we understand about customer retentions, and hopefully if we approach it from that perspective, we don't have this sort of train crash that you were sort of alluding to in years 2, 3, 4. If you manage that customer base and the retention of it properly, that's one of the things we're interested in, particularly if it's SaaS revenue or the equivalent of SaaS revenue.
Yeah, each of the three acquisitions have had that formula to them, so they've all had high degrees of recurring income. And I think if we look back over time, the statistics might show that that actually through the acquisitions, the weighted average of the proportion of fixed income of total income has increased. So it's been a true and therefore the opportunity for it to fall off a cliff doesn't happen.
Yeah, well, that's very reassuring. And then just the final question on acquisitions. Jimbo James has asked, will you need to raise more equity or debt, particularly equity via placings, to do future acquisitions?
And that's a great question from Jimbo James. So we absolutely do expect to do that. Because of the fixed income nature, we've got some access to debt markets, but we are pretty cautious and conservative in our appetite for debt. So we would take it to a sensible level rather than a sort of highly leveraged level, and would seek to sort of supplement that with equity. Yeah.
And I suppose presumably, if you go to institutions with a sensible deal to acquire a good business on sensible terms, then there's no particular reason why a placing would need to be at a discount, is there?
We wouldn't expect there to be a high discount, and clearly we have had to take a level of dilution on our previous fundraising. We've only raised equity funding once so far through this M&A strategy because we've been able to fund it from our own balance sheet and from the proportion of debt that we've taken on. But we didn't take a discount at that point in time, and clearly current shareholders are not looking to be diluted particularly at this level. So yeah, we wouldn't expect to have to offer higher levels of discount to fulfil that M&A strategy.
Okay, and I mean the other thing that really irritates private investors is that when placings do happen, and even if they're done at say a 10% discount, it effectively gives a 10% haircut to existing shareholders in value terms. So would you consider doing an open offer with future placings so that existing holders could top up at the same price as the placing?
We certainly would consider that at the right kind of level to make it meaningful, to give the right sort of offer to retail investors, because it is a very difficult thing to manage. Clearly, we take advice from our Nomad and brokers to the benefits and consequences of it, but we would certainly think about that as a sensible way of protecting everybody.
Yes, that's good, because I think it can really alienate the private investors if we're sort of frozen out of discounted fundraising.
It's very unfair, and I might add also, you know, from a director's perspective, it's similar. We don't get the opportunity largely to get involved in anything of that nature either. And we're, you know, significant shareholders in our own right as a group.
Yeah, okay. Right, let's move on to the most exciting bit. This is probably the main reason I'm personally invested in the company, is the supplier networking and accelerated payments products that you're developing. Could you outline the situation there?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are extremely excited about it, and I think there's a lot of inherent interest in what we're trying to do there. So presently and historically, we have taken all of our revenue from very, very large buying organisations, and we've got to that number of about 500 customers through that mechanism, selling them great software that they want to buy and then buy again and stick with and use for long-term periods. They're, of course, using our software to manage their supply chain in the goods not for resale indirect cost area. And they're using it, we think, to, or we estimate, to spend to with about 1 million to 2 million suppliers. So they're using our software to manage those suppliers, and that equates to about 50 to 100 billion pounds a year of spend that they're using our software to manage. And we think that allied to that, we have this technological drift of how trade is happening between buyers and suppliers in the 21st century. So if you look at in the consumer world, you're trading online every day electronically, making your payments and receiving your paperwork to support the transfer of goods. And the physical movement of goods happens very straightforwardly these days. Similarly, in a large corporate relationship, electronic trading has been happening for many, many decades now. And so things have very much moved forward in those two areas. But in the area of goods not for resale, non-strategic suppliers, or the relationship between a small supplier and a large buyer, actually electronic trading has suffered very, very low levels of take-up. And here we're not talking about a PDF on an email, which is just sort of an accelerated paper invoice in the post. We're talking about true electronic trading. Now, we have spent a good 2 to 3 years now developing the capability for any supplier to trade with its customer electronically through the and over the internet.
And through a variety of technical means.
Through whichever technical means that supplier might want to transmit their invoice or their purchase order in the opposite direction. So we are about enabling electronic trading for that raft of supplier buyer relationships that aren't presently covered. And we feel that we're uniquely placed because we have software that is embedded within the buying organisations, the customers of those 1 million to 2 million suppliers. And so we've developed software which enables that, and we're trying to roll that out now between the early adopters, and Screwfix was an example of the first fantastic partner to work with to put this kind of trading practice in place. And we expect to be able to roll out that operational capability to all of our buying organisations over a long time, but our target is to do perhaps 50 over the next 3 years. So imagine that, 50 different buying organisations working with their 250,000 or so suppliers, trading fully electronically for those buying organisations. And we think that would be a substantial value add to the sort of the mechanism of trading in the UK. As part of that process, they get the supplier clearly has an opportunity to view and get visibility of its invoices and the status of its invoice as it flows through the buyer's purchasing cycle. And at any one particular point in time, and that the savings of there are obvious, of course. The savings are there that they don't need to make many phone calls or emails or communicate with the buyer through sort of traditional fashions, cost-inefficient fashions, to find out the status of their invoice. And of course, one of those status of their invoices is when it's approved for payment, but it's sat on the purchase ledger awaiting to be paid. And that gives us an opportunity to offer an accelerated payment to the supplier. And that's where our APF offer comes in. So we're looking there to provide on a spot factoring basis model. So there's no tie-ins for the supplier. They can get their money on the day with six clicks and 3 minutes to be able to provide an early payment at a market rate of discount without any of the tie-ins to the supplier that that traditional methods of acceleration or factoring has. And we think that that's a massive opportunity. So we're very excited about it. We're working with a small pipeline of our existing customers to convince them and help them see the benefits to themselves and to their suppliers, and to help them get into an early adopter stage. So we're looking to commit to for commitments from five of our buying organisations, our customers, to go down that pathway with us, and to get a commitment from them by the end of our financial year, and to have one or two that are up and running, either supplier networking and or offering the accelerated payment facility.
And of course, this is heavily supported by governments at the moment. There's a lot of pressure on people to trade electronically, a lot of timescales given. There's very little support for SME funding. So again, that sort of thing is very helpful to us. So we sorry about the wailing.
That's all right.
Carrying us away to the hospital.
the benefits there, I think, are very similar. I certainly, as a consumer, didn't notice when all of a sudden the insurance on my car and all those sorts of things, I don't get documents anymore. I'm on a portal. I can see it all. I can download it if I wish to. And this is just, if you like, a trend that is, I think, just going to happen. The SME suppliers need to move forward. They need to stop all the silly things that have been happening with sort of paper and all those things. And we support every method of transport, including paper, including fully electronic stuff. So it's a great opportunity, and inevitably it's a matter of time before the adoption picks up pace.
Yeah, so can you give us a bit more? I know you talked about sort of trials being done in the current financial year. So, I mean, one reader asks, essentially, when will you know if it's working commercially?
Well, we're a bit further ahead than trials. What we are saying is that we've got early adopters, so we have a commercial model that works, and we would expect that every contract that we sign will certainly work commercially for us at the supplier networking level. The biggest question for us, which we are unclear about yet, but there are some statistics around in the area, is the rate of take-up of the accelerated payment facility. So it's a great question, and we are not clear about it, but we are told and are using a take-up rate of about 10% of spend as being acceleratable. If you think about the macroeconomic drivers, we've seen over the last certainly 5 years, maybe as long as 10 years now, a reduction in the level of generic funding into SME world. So there is a cash-starved, cash-hungry population of suppliers out there in the UK looking for funding. And this offers them a quick route to fast, non-committed funding. So the inherent demand, we think, is there. And as long as we're offering a sensible, transparent market rate, and that will be a clear variable which we need to work on over time, then there should be a good opportunity for it to be successful and achieve those rates of take-up that I've described at about 10%. Now, the other figures in the market to support that, first of all, that number is not Proactis's number. We have partnered so far in our product development cycle with a company called Ultimate Finance, who is a specialist lender to SMEs, and that's their view of the level of take up that ought to arise. There are other measures in the market. We've seen some anecdotal work from our quotes from Tungsten, that is a provider of APF to a different customer grouping, but their suggestion is that in the SME world it should be 8-12%, I think, is the terms that they've used in the past. And then separately from a competitor, we've heard 60% of eligible spend. And here they're sort of pulling out things like utility spend or rent spend. So more difficult to equate and to make a like-for-like comparison there. But as I say, our partner here that is a specialist lender to SMEs says that we ought to be looking at 10% as a take-up rate. So it needs time to bed in and to work and to grow. And it may be as long as 6 to 12 months before we get good, clear indications of how the APF take-up is working.
I think we also have what I call the noise from the market. And some of the noise is helpful and some of the noise is unhelpful. You know, we do similar things to, say, tungsten, for example, but we do them completely differently. I mean, we are a technology automation company first, and we're using that technology with our own customers to try to accelerate this. And it's not the same thing as going out and selling new big clients internationally or anything else. And we're also fighting some of the more conventional things that have been around for a while, like factoring. You know, we are not the same as factoring. It is a completely different process and a completely different deliverable. So, you know, when we go to talk to one of our clients and we have this early conversations, you're trying to clarify why we are different, not why we're the same.
And quite rightly, there's a lot of challenge from our buying organisations because of the negative PR that's around the, you know, charging suppliers. So there's a lot of protection of their supply chain, quite rightly, and we've got to be very cognizant of that. So that's why things don't move perhaps as quickly as anybody wants them, and it's a very sensitive area. So we just need to be cautious as we go through the process. We're seeing it, clearly there's nothing in terms of numbers from this opportunity that we've advised or helped FinCap, who provide our sort of market figures. There's nothing from this opportunity within those figures. So it's all on top of what the market is predicting.
Yeah, and there is no risk on the existing business by what we're doing with the advanced payments and the supply network.
Yeah. Sorry, go on. If you want to finish your point.
No, I've finished it now. They're totally additional, really. The existing business has to keep doing what it does.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in terms of monetizing the new supply networking accelerator, you've got the two elements, really, haven't you? You've got the accelerated payments product, where you should get a cut of the financing charges when it's sort of up to speed. And then, if my memory serves me correctly from when I met you last year, was it £50 per annum that you charge each individual supplier? Is that the right figure?
That's right. We treat the new customer group, which are the suppliers of our present customers, as precisely that, a new customer group, and we aim to provide them value-added services for the usage of our software. And we think the £50 per annum is a non-tariff based, de minimis charge for some great value add. And the value that they're getting is no need to chase and harry and waste time on pointless administrative processes of chasing up invoice status, as an example. They get to maintain their own supplier record, which historically has been highly inaccurate and held and kept by the customer organisations or the buying organisations. So they're getting added value benefits for a de minimis fee. We felt it extremely important that we don't adopt the sort of punitive model of tariff-based charging for using the network to trade electronically, as is the case in many of our sort of competitors. So we want it to be as barrier-free as it could be, but clearly there is a charge for getting value. And we've put a de minimis figure on £50 per annum. Now, a sensible question also would be, how the hell can you make £50 per annum out of a supplier relationship? Well, the reason for that is because the profile of spend within our population of buying organisations is that 70 to 80% of those buyers and suppliers are sending less than 5 invoices per annum. So in the interest of trading electronically, we're processing, or we would be processing less than 5 invoices per annum for £50 per year, and we can make money on that at that level. We will charge £50 per annum, high degree of recurring income, again in that area too. Slightly differently in that it's sort of non-contract and it's a high number, it's a small value, but the same principle of sticky revenue, long-term revenue. And then yes, you're right, Paul, we would effectively take a cut of the financing costs on the APF.
Okay, I suppose go on, Rod.
I think it's as well just to remember, all of our suppliers are on our network. The ones that we take the £50 off are for some advanced features which give them quite a lot of extra benefits. So what we're not doing is going out there on a recruitment drive to recruit new suppliers. We already
have suppliers
on the network.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of, if you like, energising them and farming them for that £50.
And what better energizer than their own customer? So this is a buyer-sponsored exercise to bring and drive electronic trading into the buying organization. That's the crucial piece as well. The benefit to the buyer is that they get electronic trading, something that they've been working hard to get for many, many years throughout their supply chain and been unsuccessful in being able to enable. And of course, you can only do it through automation with so many suppliers to manage. And now our software is capable of delivering that automation for them.
Is there an opportunity to persuade or induce the your customer to mandate that its supplier base takes up this product from yourselves?
Absolutely, and it's part of our commercial negotiation.
Okay, excellent. Well, that sounds interesting.
In the case of Screwfix, that's exactly what they've done.
In fact, Screwfix have a negative incentive in that they have agreed to pay the £50 for each of the suppliers that doesn't want to pay it themselves.
Really?
Absolutely. And alternatively, there are other buying organisations that are asking the obvious question, well, what's in it for me, as well as the benefits of electronic trading, what's in it for me in terms of cash? And we're working with them to get to a level that still provides sufficient value for Proactis, but gives them part of the stake, yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. So in terms of the £50 then, just thinking about what costs could be associated, in the worst case scenario then, if a supplier submitted 200 or 300 paper invoices each year, would your processing costs outweigh the £50 that you receive in the fee for that supply being using your service?
Probably not, but we wouldn't make any money.
You have to look at it across the population, Paul. I think that's the important thing. So if you look at a standard buying organisation that might be receiving, 100,000 invoices per annum, the buying organisation would naturally be paying about £50,000 or so per annum to process those paper invoices. Now that might be across 5,000 different suppliers. So 5,000 different suppliers at 50 quid is £250,000. So we'd effectively be receiving £250,000 a year for the processing of 100,000 invoices per year. So that's the value inflection point that we think we can bring through automation.
I see. So you are actually physically handling paper invoices then, Proactis is that right?
As one of the many different varieties and types and styles that an invoice can arrive into a buying organisation, we provide a bureau which can facilitate that. And the vast majority, by the way, isn't in paper.
Okay.
So if we take our bureau capability, we currently process about 50 million paper documents through it.
Per annum.
Yeah.
So we have a capability, and it's not staffed up with hundreds of people. A good example would be, if you don't send the actual paper, if you send me a PDF, I don't physically have to handle the paper then. I'm getting the equivalent of paper, but with a PDF, which is easy. So part of our job is to educate people about moving up that electronic scale, if I can call it that, where paper is the worst case, and where XML, if you like, machine to machine with no intervention is the best case.
I see.
If we automate more, obviously the cost goes down.
Yeah, Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, I think it's...
Going back to the M&A strategy, this is the key capability that we acquired and needed to acquire to facilitate this supplier networking opportunity for us. We needed to have that resource and capability in-house, effectively at zero cost to the group, so that we could make it effective at £50 per annum. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been effective at £50 per annum, which we think is the competitive advantage that we have over other charging rates that competitors are providing.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're out of time, gents, so that's been really, really interesting. So to summarise then, you've got a good core business and there's exciting upside on the new products, I think. That's the way I look at it anyway. But, you know, we'll just have to wait, I guess, for things to develop over the next year or two. So any sort of closing remarks, any key points that we've missed?
Nothing. I think you've summarised it well. We've got a great business that's going well and growing well, and we've got fantastic opportunities to pursue through the consolidation of a fragmented procurement sector in terms of M&A, and then we have a super exciting opportunity to work on to access this new customer group, which is really vast. And we're right at the start of that, so we're very busy working really hard to really grow this group aggressively over the next 3 to 5 years.
Brilliant. Oh, well, good luck with it, gents. Obviously, as a shareholder, I'm hoping it all works out. So, okay, well, thanks very much for your time, gents. Let's wrap it up there, and we'll hopefully speak again perhaps in a few months' time.
Excellent.
Hopefully.
Thank you.
For the time.
Cheers.
Thanks, then. Bye.
Bye.
Paul Scott.